All you need is one guy or girl to stand up and say, fuck this. And everyone goes, voice of a generation, thank you. I've been thinking that. I never had the guts to stand up and say it. And all of a sudden, fuck this has a backbeat. You know, like John Lennon always said, say what you mean what you say, put a beat to it. Go.
You only need 5% or less to, like, embrace ideas and change it and, you know, change the way people think all over again.
There's always going to be people who are artistically inclined who are going to somehow find something that brings them into the same room where they're going to exchange information, and then they're going to take that out.
It becomes a lineage. These people find each other and this timeline grows.
This is a public service announcement with guitar.
Kicking ass, you're doing something new, and you don't give a shit about fucking commerciality. And that's what punk is.
It's really a kind of philosophical thing about how you look at something.
Originally, punk meant, you know, a guy in prison who got fucked up the ass. And that's still what it means to people in prison.
I think it starts with Brando in The Wild One. The famous line for that, of course, was, what are you rebelling against? And Brando turns to the camera and says, what do you got?
The rebellious part of it is very important because people get too complacent. And I think the fight against that complacency is punk rock.
If you look a little back, you see it was in 50s rock and roll is really punk.
Running across the motherfucking stage on one leg like this duck, like doing some duck walk shit is some punk shit, you know what I mean?
Gone like a coup.
There is your mom's music, and then all of a sudden here comes Elvis Presley.
It's always very important for, like, iconoclastic artists to upset things.
Every culture, every century has a handful of these dudes, guys and girls, who they just go, oh, no, you don't.
Well, I sort of had a crown, but I'm out on the road again. I'm on the road again.
The hippies were the real punks, if you ask me.
That was just as punk rock as anything, when everyone was against Vietnam and they were doing their own thing, and they were all having parties, taking LSD at Woodstock and all that.
People were sort of united against the war, but they were united generally against the establishment.
I always liked hippies, man. I mean, this country couldn't go wrong with having a lot of hippies. You know, they aren't going to hurt anybody. They just want to get high, hear some music, and fuck, you know.
We wanted punk to wipe out the hippies, blow up the whole world of rock and roll, and start all over again.
Too many teardrops for one heart to be crying.
When I was a kid, they used to call punk rock, like, you know, like Lenny K's Nuggets, you know, those garage bands that he came out with, and that's what I thought punk rock was.
In his liner notes, he said, well, you know, some critics are referred to this as punk, and right after that, you just started sort of seeing that word a little bit.
They were kind of like, you know, young kids, American kids, that were trying to copy what the Rolling Stones were doing and some of the other English bands, and weren't really as even as professional as them.
I mean, I grew up with the British Invasion, but there were also really great American bands that kind of got lost in the shuffle, like Question Mark and the Mysterians and the Standells and Count Five, you know, Psychotic Reaction. You know, they're very simple three-chord rock.
I can't get your love, I can't get affection. Oh, little girl, Psychotic Reaction. And I feel like this.
there is a school of thought that has Andy Warhol figuring quite significantly in kind of some of the grooves and scratches that became punk rock.
The Velvet stood out from that whole hippie culture with the dressed in black, the wraparound shades, the subject matter of the material, the literary influences, you know, the sadomasochism, the drugs. It was so attractive and so alluring, and I just loved it because it was saying fuck off to the hippies as well.
Opening people's minds up to other possibilities can only be done sometimes with rabid ideas. You're really trying to be polite about it in a way and say, hey, you know, don't you get it? And generally they don't, and you have to, like, push the boundaries.
Here she comes. You better watch your step.
Nico came and joined the band, and this was kind of the first turn that she took in her career. She was a top fashion model.
'Cause everybody knows.
Nobody understood it at the time, and that's where I suddenly got a different view of Andy, that he had the vision of what PR really is and how to propel image. The astonishing thing about Lou's talent at the time was the literary background, but also he could sit down with a guitar and just pop up a song about almost anything.
Hey, white boy, what you doing uptown? Hey, white boy, you chasing all women around?
But when that record came out, it was actually listenable, you know, and it was, you know, to me, it was a beautiful record. I mean, I played it all the time.
Lou Reed and his crew making this atonal music coming from art and heroin and death in the middle of like, feel good, that's punk rock.
Sing out the jams, motherfucker!
The MC5 was part of an entire generation that was in agreement that the direction the country was going in was wrong. We were the ones that were going to have to go to Vietnam. We didn't agree with the way they treated people of color in America. We didn't agree with the way they suppressed our cultural efforts, you know, our ideas about things. And we just wanted to be heard.
Our basic outlook was cultural revolution by any means necessary, including rock and roll, dope, and fucking in the streets. That was number one.
We read in the Black Panther newspaper that Huey Newton said there needs to be a White Panther Party to do parallel work that the Black Panthers were doing. And we said, that's us. We're ready. Yeah, let's go.
When you get the feeling you got to suck them out, put that mic in my hand.
One of our songs was called Kick Out the Jams, and we cooked up this intro for the tune where Tyner would scream, "Kick out the jams, motherfuckers." And we knew it was a little bit wicked, you know, and we were kind of breaking a taboo. Gosh, they said a bad word. But what the hell, you know, this is rock and roll and it's all in good fun. Well, when they rushed the album out, the programmers heard the motherfucker and they lost it, man. They lost it. And it effectively broke the back of the MC5's entire campaign. It's hard to think of today when you almost have to say motherfucker.
I mean, you're talking about people in a rock and roll band, you know. We're on acid, you know. We're smoking 50 joints a day, you know, around riding in little vans for hundreds of miles with James Brown playing at 10 in the car, you know.
We had some friends up in Ann Arbor that shared some principles with the MC5, sonically especially, and they called their band the Stooges.
Give me a danger, little stranger, and I'll give you a piece. Give me a danger, little stranger, and I'll heal your disease.
I remember the first time I saw Iggy Pop, he was covered with oil and glitter and... And everybody was kind of staring at him going, what the hell is this? You know, it was kind of a really strange, different kind of attitude. He was kind of jumping around like a spastic, you know.
Now if you will be my lover, I will shiver and sing.
Primal beats, you know, slabs of sound, brutally, psychologically honest lyrics. You know, in a metaphor, I mean, I want to be your dog, those kinds of things, you know, things that he had grabbed from the blues.
Now I want to be your dog. Now I want to be your dog.
I think the transformative experience that happened to Ig was, and I was at that show too, he saw the Doors.
Seeing the Doors change them. They were mesmerized, you know, they just, what they saw in that performance gave them a whole new lease on life.
You know, these were bands that weren't selling records, you know. Iggy sort of claimed, as far as he knew, he didn't sell any records until he came to New York and met this newer generation of, like, the Ramones and stuff, who were completely informed by the Stooges, which I think was shocking for him.
It seemed like a lot of the people who started the early, both the punk and the new wave bands in America, were the only Stooges fan in their town, the only Velvet Underground fan, and then we all moved to bigger towns and met each other and started bands.
You know, rock and roll had become this just bedenimed kind of drum solo kind of thing. And what we wanted to do was bring it down to 3 minutes and put that little Richard drag on top of it. And that's what rock and roll was to us. You know, we were just trying to make rock and roll, you know.
Punk rock wasn't even a thought at that time, I don't think, but the seeds for punk were certainly being sown by the Dolls and by all the bands that had come previous to that, such as the Velvets and Stooges and the MC5.
And you're our people, that'll be the honest way.
In England, there was this thing, this controversy, because this guy said, what do you say, mock rock? Which, you know, I mean, I could have cared less at the time, but I can see how it kind of like galvanized kids who thought, like, well, this is the real deal, so what do you know, you old fart?
First of all, music from an American group who are to the Stones what the Monkees were to the Beatles, a pale and amusing derivative. These are the New York Dolls.
When I saw them, and they're kind of the way that they didn't care about nothing, and that just really struck me straight away, you know what I mean? It was like something completely different to anything else that was going on there.
Every punk band that I knew in London, and I knew all of them, they all had both of the New York Dolls albums.
No one had told us that we had all this impact. You know, we didn't know anything about it.
Yeah, we would have moved to England and stayed here.
When I say I'm in love, you best believe I'm in love, L-U-V.
I know there's this thing, oh, Malcolm McLaren managed the Dolls, but, you know, he hung around with us for, like, the last 2 weeks of our existence. We were, like, We were going down in flames.
Malcolm thought, like, what's the most shocking thing in America? They're really afraid of communism in America. So let's make all these red clothes and have a red party.
Then for shock value, you put a big flag with a hammer and sickle in the back. They didn't sing about being communists. It was just there to irritate people, and it sure did.
It's so funny to think now that, you know, that communism in the States was like, child molesting, you know.
So this was it. I mean, you know, in America, which we were such a hard pill to swallow.
You know, everyone was booing them, you know, faggots, get off the stage, and, well, you know, a lot of that stuff.
We were number one, man, and we were way ahead of the pack, and that's when we fell and broke our leg, and bam, everybody else just
the red man led the show, and that look was kind of the final blow.
And it's sort of interesting, because that sort of marks the point where glam rock died and punk rock started.
As the Dolls sort of began to wind down and then eventually broke up, there were other bands coming in that had been kind of in the circle of the Dolls and had been inspired by the Dolls, and they started forming bands.
In New York, pre-75, the punk rock scene was probably just starting to bubble, but nobody knew it was going to be the punk rock scene. And we were just taking notes from the MC5 and taking notes from the Stooges, and the cauldron was starting to bubble.
You know, everybody was so fed up with what was going on with rock and roll, which was Deep Purple. These big bloated concerts where they do these organ solos for 20 minutes or these guitar solos for 20 minutes.
The Bowery was still the Bowery. It wasn't cleaned up yet. It was still fun and a little dangerous and edgy. And it was a different cultural, social world back then.
Also, everybody was sick of the Vietnam War, which started in 1965 and went to 1975. So it was kind of like, you know what, we don't want to be political anymore. You know, we want to kind of be about don't step on my blue suede shoes, which is probably the most political thing you could say, because that's about personal freedom. The Dictators are a kind of an unknown band, and they were actually the first. They came out in 74 with an album called Dictators Go Girl Crazy. Handsome Dick Manitoba was on the cover, you know, and he had this big afro, and he was dressed in this wrestling suit. But inside the cover, if you pulled it out, there was a cover, and they were all in black leather jackets sitting at a White Castle hamburger stand. And that's when we said, yes!
And we're at the White Castles and pussy and getting drunk and playing rock and roll, and we're going to spit out our culture and what we think is cool.
You heard a lot about these groups, often from word of mouth and from other people on the street, and a lot of flyers were up, and then people were pressing their own singles. You know, it was truly alternative, because it really was people doing it for themselves and because they wanted to express something.
We were kind of like smashing those idols, you might say, of the status quo of guitar, bass, and drums. And we took them all out, and then we had only two guys, and then the name Suicide on top of it. And yeah, we knew it was different.
I mean, Suicide were around at the time that the Dolls were around. They were pre-punk, you know, and they were doing something that was so completely off the deep end.
And they were up there, like, with their radiated glasses and radiated music.
Alan Vega would come out with this motorcycle chain that was like 8 feet long. And Marty started playing, and he'd sing a couple of notes. Then he'd start whipping the floor with his 8-foot bull, this chain. This completely frightened people out of the room.
I would have to think that Suicide had to be a tremendous influence on absolutely everybody. Who's riding on a motorcycle?
at that time, there were only two bars to play that played original music, and that was CBGB's and Max's.
I opened in December 73 as CBGB's, which stands for Country Bluegrass Blues. I made it a policy, the only way they could play here, not they could, the only way they could play here is they had to do their own music. That was the first time I had this new wave of what we call punk music with the group Television. But they didn't sound good to me.
I saw Television maybe 20 times, I think. And I saw them, I think, in some of their very first shows. So I was really inspired by that whole scene very early on. There's something very French in a way for me about Television. I don't know why, but aesthetically they were very different, and their music could have extended instrumental passages that would just lift you away and transport you somewhere.
Jesus died for somebody's sins, but not mine.
We had Patty here in the spring of 75 for 7 weeks.
She's one person who sort of really predates punk as far as like being an artist, doing performance and doing writing, but at the same time she really informed punk to such a degree. And so she's very significant in the way she comes in.
I thought Patti Smith was the queen of the universe. I mean, the number of times I sat in front of her first album, turned up all the way on my stereo. I mean, I just thought, this is it. This is rock that I've dreamed about.
The boy looked at Johnny. Johnny wanted to run. Johnny wanted to move, but the movie kept moving as planned. The boy gripped Johnny. He pressed him against a locker. He drove it in, he drove it home, he drove it deep in Johnny.
These records were not records that were what you would think of punk rock. They weren't sort of, you know, sped up Chuck Berry riffs, and it wasn't, you know, this kind of hammer, you know, punk rock chording thing. These were more otherworldly in a way.
Suddenly, Johnny gets a feeling. He's been surrounded by horses.
There was always an intellectual side to the punk movement.
A lot of those bands from that time were picking up influences from the poets and the writers that they had grown up listening to. Rimbaud, certainly, and actually a big one was Jack Kerouac, you know, On the Road. I remember Richard Hell walking in one night. Richard kind of walked in wearing these clothes, safety pinned together, and Malcolm was totally taken by that idea of, like, anti-fashion.
He was very bright, and he wrote Blank Generation. And when he did that and sang that with Television first, and then he started Richard Hell and the Voidoids, Malcolm saw that and took it back to London.
Some of the safety pins and the stapled cuffs and things like that were more of a necessity of people actually trying to hold their clothes together.
And then in London, we'd see these pictures of kids who call themselves punks, and they'd have safety pins all over the place. They'd rip the clothing on purpose just so they could buy a whole bunch of safety pins and put the safety pins in the rips all over the place. And then we'd have to hear about how they're on the dole and they don't have any money. Oh.
Ramones were rehearsing down the hall from us one day, and in the rehearsal place, and Joey comes over and he goes, "Oh, David, come down the hall and hear my band," you know. So I get down the hall, and they play me a song, and I was like, "You gotta be kidding! Like, get a job, you know." I had no idea that they were so fabulous.
In the early 70s, we discovered bands like the Stooges, the MC5, the Velvet Underground, then later the New York Dolls.
Didi had heard about CBGB because Didi was a friend of Richard Hell.
A few Sundays later, we put television in and the Ramones. They were worse than television.
It was a really interesting set because our equipment kept breaking down and we kept breaking strings and we would get into fights between songs, so we hardly ever even finished a song.
I remember seeing the Ramones and hating them. I hated them. I walked out so pissed off that my friend brought me here, and for 24 hours I could not think of anything else about how mad I was that this guy brought me to see this lousy band. The next night I was back.
First time I saw the Ramones, the whole set, maybe 12 songs went by in about 16 minutes, and I remember thinking, like, what the hell was that?
We were missing the essence of rock and roll, which was basically what we grew up with, was the three-minute song. What happened, though, was that because we were playing so fast, the three-minute songs became one-and-a-half-minute songs.
I take it, Diddy!
I got puppy!
As far as why we're playing so fast, that's the way we play.
Let's go! Let's go! Let's go!
Legs McNeil and John Holmstrom had this idea that they start a magazine, then they could probably get free records and free drinks, and they'd say that they were representing a magazine. And since there was no magazine that they could represent, because nobody cared about this kind of downtown music, they started their own magazine.
And John wanted to call it Teenage News, which I thought was a very stupid idea. I didn't realize it at the time, but it was from an unreleased New York Dolls record.
I said, okay, what do we call a magazine about, you know, comics and fashion and funny stuff?
Why don't we call it punk?
I was like, perfect. We'll call it punk. The first night we decided to do any kind of interviews, we went to CBGB's. Legs insisted on dragging along his friend Mary Harron.
And that was the night we met Lou Reed. It was the first time I saw the Ramones.
The Ramones came out, and they counted off the wrong song. 1, 2, 3, 4, and they all went for the wrong song, and they threw down their guitars in self-disgust. And it was great.
I was just like, you know, completely shell-shocked. But it was so, I felt I was seeing something completely new.
That was the night we met Lou Reed, and I went up to him and said, oh, we're going to interview you for Punk Magazine. John said, yeah, we'll put you on the cover. And he said, oh, your circulation must be fabulous.
I can't seem to face up to the fact. I'm tense and nervous and I can't relax. I can't sleep because my bed's on fire. Don't touch me, I'm a real live wire.
And the media picked up punk rock and started calling television Talking Heads, Patti Smith. Everybody in New York was punk rock all of a sudden.
Psycho killer, pest can say.
None of the bands called themselves punk or particularly wanted to be punk. The Ramones certainly didn't want to be called that.
Unfortunately, I think it was detrimental to us as far as the straight media was concerned, because they assumed we were a bunch of hooligans and were kind of afraid of us.
And the bands were so diverse that I don't even know if that's what they were.
You know, some of these bands, I wouldn't have classified them as punk, but they have a punk attitude, like Television. See, I don't feel Television, but they are. I mean, they came from the punk. Patti Smith, if you want to take the lyric, all right, you know, some of these things in a sense are punk. The Dead Boys were more rock and roll than punk, but they certainly had punk lyrics and a punk attitude.
When punk rock came out, it was very threatening and frightening to some people. Even Debbie Harry talks about when she would go to radio stations, people were like afraid of her because they heard she was punk rock, like she was going to pull out a knife or something.
hang around. We're getting no more.
So I remember one time seeing Blondie at CBGB's, and I think it was Heart of Glass that they were playing, and it sounded almost like a disco song, and it sounded much more musical and much more mainstream than any of the bands had played before. And it sounded like something that you could actually start hearing on the radio.
And what the major labels had done, it said, okay, New Wave is acceptable. Blondie, The Knack, The Cars, Pink Neckties, snazzy suit jackets and all. But we don't want anything to do with punk.
When the UK kind of blew up, which was immediately after, really, or almost at the same time, there was a different vibe, and we were really, you know, my friends and I were really interested in that, curious as to how does this same kind of thing, how is it expressed in a somewhat different cultural climate?
My mother called me and said, punk started in England. And I'm like, oh, Mom.
The political social climate at the time in the 70s was crucial to the formation of punk rock because punk rock was talking about the dole queue and the winter of discontent.
The fabric of society at that time was that when we first started, it was, in our eyes, was falling apart. We had a 3-day week, you had rubbish strikes.
You know, everywhere you went, it was like bad news. They were talking about burying people at sea in the Mersey because the grave diggers were on site. I mean, it was that bad. God save
the
Queen!
The time was just right. It wasn't orchestrated. It was like all these elements of people not being happy with what was going on at present.
So I suppose that probably had quite a strong push for all of us to say, well, we better do something for ourselves rather than rely on anybody else. God save the Queen! She ain't no human being.
There is no future. And England's dreaming. Well, there was no such word as punk at the time, if I remember. The first time I heard that word used in conjunction with what we were doing was, I think it was Caroline Coon or one of these journos. And I was a little bit shocked, to be quite honest, because, you know, I thought we were kind of, you know, I didn't really know what we were doing. All I knew, it was kind of different from the garbage that was going around at the time.
'74, '75, '76, I mean, the place to be was, you know, the King's Road. It was the only place that was interesting.
The one thing that would draw us to the King's Road was Vivian and Malcolm's shop. That was the one thing you had to go and see and hang out in.
I've never seen anyone who looked like this ever before in my life. She had just this white hair that just kind of stuck out all over the place and these purple eyebrows drawn on.
And I'd never met anyone like Malcolm and Vivian, because they looked so fucking bizarre for a start.
People like Vivian Westwood are a kind of social sponge. I don't mean she sponges as in leech. I mean sponge as in she soaks up what's going on. The mood line, you know, she kind of feels all the political and economic moods and then translates it into her clothes and everything.
The trousers all come with a little loincloth on the back. Everybody wants to know what that's for. It's just a loincloth. It's just a gesture of some kind of tribalism, really. You could always point out that maybe this, it's got some connection with the fact that this zip goes right round the back up the arse as well. I don't know.
First time I went into Malcolm's store here in England, and I saw these bondage pants, you know, that had straps on them where you're supposed to, like, strap your legs together. And it seemed like the dumbest idea in the world to me. I mean, how are you going to walk? Just kind of bounce down the street? And I thought, nobody's going to wear that. And I came back to England about 6 months later, and all these kids with their legs strapped together bouncing down the street.
I don't think punk would have happened without Malcolm and Vivian, to be honest. Something would have happened, and it might have even been called punk, but it wouldn't have looked the way it did. And the look of it was so important.
Saturday afternoon, people used to flip between Acme Attractions and Let It Rock. And John was one of that crowd. We arranged this meeting for him to come down to meet us for a drink. And he got the gig. He said, what are you called? And he said, the Sex Pistols. And he said, that's awful. It's so bad. I love it. I am an Antichrist.
I am an Antichrist. We'd been reading about the Sex Pistols in the NME, a gig at the St. Martin's College of Art, I think it was. The one where somebody shouted out from the audience, you can't play. And one of them said, so what?
We read the first review of the Sex Pistols in NME. Don't look over your shoulder, the Sex Pistols are coming.
And he said, oh look, there's a review here for this band in London who do Stooges songs.
Nobody did Stooges songs.
They do version of No Fun. And we thought, oh.
And there was this fantastic line of, well, we're not into music, we're into chaos.
Which appealed to Howard.
And it was those two things that, that kind of went ding, ding, with me. You build the soul with this big sensation. Ba, 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 ba. This kind of feeling could destroy a nation. We successfully saw them twice the weekend we came down to London, February 1976. I said to Malcolm, do you want to come and play at our college? About 100 people turned up, and I think we know that included Morrissey, half of Joy Division and New Order.
Apparently everybody in that audience started a band. All 7 million of them.
The 100 Club Punk Rock Festival was a two-day event that featured bands like The Pistols, The Damned, The Clash, Subway Sect, and Susie and the Banshees.
I think that my first reaction when I went down into the 100 Club was, I can't believe they've taken this all seriously.
The formation of the bands was quite liquid, you know. You 1 minute Tony James would be in the Damned, and the next minute, you know, Chrissy Hynde would, you know, we'd all be feeling each other and seeing how it went, kind of thing. So, Chrissy was in an early incarnation of the Damned, which she wanted to call it Mike Hunt's Honourable Discharge. A charming name. I've got a new rose, I've got a good. Yes, I knew that I always would.
They were more like an American punk band than the London bands, which were, unfortunately, they didn't always have a great sense of humor.
We used to jump from, you know, top of tall building to another tall building to steal a flag, you know, or to get in someone else's hotel room to shit in their bed, you know. These things don't happen anymore, unfortunately, you know.
I remember going to see Damned, I think, and I'm walking back with Mark P, who had just started this, was starting this fanzine Sniffing Glue.
You've got to get out there and shove it down people's throats, your ideas. And if it means being a bit violent, you know? So okay, you know?
Sniffing Glue obviously was like the first Xerox copy fanzine. It was like an expression of our own thing rather than this more glossy American magazines, you know?
The first issue of Sniffin' Glue put Blue Oyster Cult on the cover, then had the Sex Pistols on the cover.
Yeah, the Clash, the Damned and the Pistols were all about the same kind of fame, stroke, notoriety, whatever you want to call it at the time, until the Pistols were lucky enough to be invited on the Grundy Show. I mean, anyone could have gone on and swore. Joe Strummer could have done it. I could have. I'm very good at swearing, you know.
Go on, you've got another 5 seconds. Say something outrageous.
You dirty bastard.
Gone again.
You dirty fucker.
What a clever boy.
What a fucking rotter.
Well, that's it for tonight. I'll be seeing you soon. I hope I'm not seeing you again. From me, though, good night.
I'm going to complain to ITV.
I really can't believe the reaction that it had. That, you know, people kicked their TV sets in and were outraged. The filth and the fury. I mean, you could never predict that that would go so ballistic.
That's how they leapt across in the old fame states, and they were the kind that was the filth and the fury and the front pages and all this stuff. I am an anti-Christ. I am an anarchist. Don't know what I want, but I know how to get it. I want to destroy, falsify.
Went completely mad from that point on, and we all like set off. I think the next day we set off on the Anarchy tour. The Pistols, ourselves, and Johnny Thunder and the Heartbreakers. I think we had like 16 dates booked, and as we went up the motorway, the dates got less and less, and I think we ended up doing only four, and then it was back in time, just in time for Christmas.
Do you feel the publicity following the Thames television interview has been damaging, or do you think it's helped you?
I don't think it's been damaging, far from it. Whether it's helping us is another matter.
You know, a lot of shit had gone down and things going to a head between me and John. I kind of had enough at that stage.
Pistols Mark II with Sid. Bad mistake.
Nancy went over to England because Johnny Thunders and the Heartbreakers came over, and she was good friends with them, and she met Sid, and it was apparently love at first sight. But they were really bad for each other because Nancy was, you know, on the dope for a long time.
I saw the transition of what that drug can do to people, and courtesy of that horrible girl, Nancy Spungen, I just saw him completely change.
I love the Pistols because of their, again, like the Ramones, although in a very not American way, the Pistols were incredibly reductive to emotions, anger, three chords, you know, just the kind of damaged sound of rock and roll being very reduced was so beautiful to me.
It became clear that lyrics were very important to these bands, you know, they were dealing with you know, everyday matters in a very erudite and poetic fashion, I thought. Especially when you got to read the, you know, Joe Strummer's lyrics and things like that, you know.
Steel shoes on the stone cold floor. I hear the screws screaming in the corridor. The bad news and the slamming of the doors. What did I do and the what am I here for?
I took my existing poems and read them at breakneck speed, you know, because it seems to me that it was part of the house style of punk was fast, you know. You had to be fast.
A lot of the influences for the English punk scene were really mostly homegrown, really.
The kind of glam bands like the Ziggy Stardust, which is David Bowie and the Spiders from Mars, and Motley Hoople and the sensational Alex Harvey Band. Tony James and I had a band called London SS. That was like kind of before the Clash, and we used to put an advert in the Melody Maker every week saying anybody who's into the Stooges and the MC5 and the New York Dolls should get in touch with us.
Bernie brought in this kid one day, too good looking, I thought, to be in the band, and was an art student, and it was Paul Simonon. And I thought, I looked at Paul and Mick together and I thought, I got to get out of this now, because, you know, I could see they were made for each other.
It was essentially Tony James playing bass, Mick Jones guitar, and Brian James on guitar.
They formed the bands like The Damned, Generation X, The Pretenders, and of course The Clash.
Oh, don't complain. Oh, like I used to say, morning, Jack and Ed, forever to die.
Oh, and we started the first Clash album, and we didn't really want to know anything, and so we just did what we thought. We played our tracks that we had, a few tracks that we had basically our set before we made a record. Everybody sees the second record, Give Them Enough Rope, as a transitional record. And in that time, we go to loads of places we've never been before and see a lot of the world that we hadn't seen before. And all that goes in towards our third record, London Calling, which is sort of like when we come into our own in a way.
London Calling, far away to
Pistols were like really angry and loud and just yelling about it, whereas the Clash were angry and loud but questioning about it. And whereas the Pistols were just like scream about how, you know, something was wrong, the Clash would kind of say, well, this is wrong, but what are you going to do about it?
Where are GarageBand? Oh, we come from GarageBand.
Oh, oh. I remember there were a lot of places that wouldn't let us play up and down the country, universities. And that was probably something that they'd read, that we had a song called White Riot. They thought we were some sort of National Front group, whereas really the song was about white people getting up and doing it for themselves, because our black neighbours were doing it for themselves insofar as the riots and whatever. So it was time for the white people to get on with their own situation.
Things got a bit serious after a couple of years when Martin Webster's National Front started coming to punk gigs and trying to recruit people.
I think that's why we played the Rock Against Racism gig, just to sort of make it clear that we're on this side of the fence, we're not over there.
What people called the politicisation of the Clash came from two things, I would say, that Bernard said to us that we should write about what we know about. And the second thing was the way that Joe was. He was always thinking about things like that.
Strummer thought of the world and the potential of music as like a, you know, he's always making references to radio broadcasts, and, you know, this one's going out to the world. He had that kind of Woody Guthrie thing, or a kind of thing that Dylan had and Bob Marley had and sometimes John Lennon had, where they were aware of that power, but they weren't egotistical about it. And he had this sense, and he knew, and it was true, that something he would think of in his basement in Ladbroke Grove had the potential of affecting, you know, young people particularly all over the planet.
Know your rights. These are your rights.
In July of 76, we went to London, and we played the Roundhouse.
I couldn't believe it. I said, this is the audience that the Ramones deserve. This is the audience that this music needs. This is the other half.
It was just like totally, like, really short songs, really hard attack, no nonsense, and it was just like cut down bare to the bone, you know, and that was inspiring.
There were members of the Clash, the Sex Pistols.
Sid Vicious learned how to play the guitar by listening to the Ramones and just staying up for three nights on speed and playing along to Ramones records. And the Ramones were the one band, I think, that the English punks kind of looked up to.
And I remember saying to Joey, and he was like, oh, they really liked us in England. I was like, yeah, but who cares? It's England, you know?
First rehearsal I went to, we had hardly no songs, we could hardly play, and we started with a Ramones song, Blitzkrieg Bop.
The Slits were one of the best bands in the punk scene, for my money, and again, they were just so makeshift.
We were different from other girls because of our lyrics and because of the way we dressed and our attitude and everything.
I need some money to borrow. Said I surely give it back to you tomorrow.
We did not enjoy any other girl images that were around. So we stripped down all the conditioning, and punk helped us to do that.
There was a scene already, but the Roxy was the place where it all kind of, it was focused in on. Suddenly you had a place to play.
The Roxy as really officially started on January 1st, 1977, with the Clash opening.
It was a place for, where the groups could actually get up on stage and play in front of an audience.
There was a disc jockey at the time, Don Letts.
His record collection was heavily based on dub and reggae, and there was no real punk records around. It was Don diving into his collection, and magically it worked.
He would play the real roots, culture, rock, reggae, the real dub, and that's how a lot of the punky reggae evolved later on.
So reggae was the sort of soundtrack to the whole punk scene. At least it was in London. I mean, no one listened to anything else that I know of.
And it gave you an attitude that you could take on to. That's how I learned how to play, was playing along to reggae records.
All the guys that were working behind the bar were living up at Forest Hill with Don Letts, myself. We all stayed up there. Everyone always was hanging out in Don's room because he had all the records and stuff. Everyone that was hanging out there got in some band or another. I know Ariana came up there, some of the Slits would be up there, the Clash would be up there. That was the beauty of that scene. Everyone got a band together, and everyone was in a band, and everyone you knew was trying to get a band together, and you'd probably played with half of them.
To be honest, I found some of the elements at the Roxy quite disturbing. I thought I was in hell when I went there. It's like going down to the nether regions.
We didn't make any money because most of the bar staff were selling bloody spliffs behind the bar and not any drink.
Certainly speed, I think, was the drug of choice. And when the Heartbreakers came over, they were all taking smack. And so, of course, everyone was in the toilets anyway shooting speed. And then when the smack came into the scene, that was kind of, punk was over after that.
It only lasted 100 days, officially 100 days at the Roxy, because things went so fast in those days.
By the time the ball was really going for everybody, it was just, it was starting to get a little bit cliched.
Suddenly the whole country knew about it, and then everybody would turn up at gigs with what they assumed was the punk rock look, which meant a safety pin in the cheek, and like a black bin liner for clothes or something. But then again, you look at the groups. None of those groups had safety pin in their cheeks. None of them had a bin liner. So this is a whole tabloid thing that was made up.
It became a little bit regimented later on, where everyone was kind of wearing leather jackets with studs and Mohicans and all this stuff.
Punk rock itself got actually quite nasty, didn't it, towards the end, especially with all the tabloid sort of... you know, all this gobbing, spitting hate, and Sid killing himself, and Nancy, and all this weird stuff.
For the small amount of people that were really integral to the beginning of it, I suppose we'd all moved on, really.
Punk inherently was going to have a short lifespan, because the beauty of punk music, anyway, was the fact that no one really could play very good. And what happens is, if you get into a band and you actually like playing and you want to make music your life, we didn't think in terms of careers, but if you wanted to pursue that, then inevitably you got better at your craft.
It is time for
stamp of the earth sovereign. Yes, it's time you to stop.
The Pistols and the Clash, what was happening there? There was an energy there, and there was a forcefulness about what they were doing, and a determination about it, that really I could tie into the same kind of cultural revolution energy there was in New York.
There was a difference, and yet we were all there was a sense of, and now an international kind of community of thought.
The Immigration Department tried to protect us from them, denying them visas for a few days late in December. But now they're here and they're loosed upon the land. They're the Sex Pistols, the British punk rock group that began their first American concert tour last night in Atlanta.
They had this whole hype around them where they were the craziest band in history, and people were afraid to be in the same room as them. So the first half of the tour was canceled. And they ended up opening in Atlanta, and the police kept warning them that if they tried pissing on the stage or throwing up on stage or raping any women, they're going right to jail. It's pretty far from what the reality was. They were not that crazy on stage. Until they got to San Antonio. Now, this place, Randy's Rodeo, was a converted bowling alley, and there was about 2,000 rednecks there who each and every one of them wanted to personally beat the crap out of the Sex Pistols. They didn't help matters because Johnny was wearing a t-shirt that had two gay cowboys having sex with each other, and the audience was just throwing full beer cans and food and anything they could get their hands on at the Pistols, and the Pistols just kept going. Sid would take a full beer can right off the teeth and then spit on somebody, and the crowd loved it.
They had just done the most successful thing. They had achieved what every band wants. They came as a new band, starting in a couple of clubs, ending up the last day playing a huge theater in San Francisco to a giant audience, and then broke up.
Here's an interesting thing that happened. Punk rock, boom, it comes out. Then the Sex Pistols break up. Johnny Lydon forms Public Image, which to me is infinitely more interesting than the Sex Pistols. Some real musicians came out of punk rock. Like, they really wanted to do some music. And all of a sudden, Howard Devoto morphs out of the Buzzcocks. He has Magazine with a really challenging brew of music. They got a bucket full of grief from their fans, and you find out that punk rockers were some of the most narrow-minded people on the face of the earth. Talk about you grow your hair too long, what are you, hippie now? And we found it in America. You try something like you put a guitar solo in a song, the song is longer than a minute and a half, and all of a sudden, like, what's that, you know, Freebird? You're like, God, come on, give us a little room. No!
We were very much connected with the whole English post-punk thing. I mean, it seemed to me they had heard the New York bands. I mean, it was very similar to the punk thing.
The Rough Trade bands, the Raincoats and the Pop Group and Gang of Four, I mean, those bands were extremely powerful for us. The Fall, you know, in Manchester. I mean, these were just different ideas coming out that weren't just, you know, it wasn't pretty vacant.
The No Wave scene was probably best personified by James Chance. I remember I beat him up one night. I don't know why. And he had two black eyes, which actually improved his looks a little bit.
I'll tell you how I got started. It was one of the first contortions gigs. It was in, like, just this sort of hall, you know, where there wasn't any stage or anything. And all these people were just, like, sitting on the floor. And And if there's one thing that I can't stand, is people sitting on the floor at one of my shows. And so I just started wading out into the audience and pulling them up to their feet, you know. And that didn't even seem to get them very upset, so I just started, like, slapping them and stuff, you know. I was really just trying to get a reaction out of these people. And then later on, we had somebody who would come and, like drag me back after I'd been in the audience for a while.
James Chance was doing his sort of James Brown thing with people who really were, at the time, non-musicians. And he liked the idea of them making scratchy, skronky noise.
I said it's better than pleasure, and it hurts more than pain. I got what it takes to drive you insane.
By 1980, punk was really over. Because, one, all the New York bands got signed and were on tour, so there wasn't a scene at CBGB's anymore.
Patty left the scene. Television pretty much disbanded. Blondie became new wave, if not disco.
So, I don't know. I mean, at least as far as I'm concerned, it was like, well, then fuck it. I'll start a fucking band. And I wanted to challenge people, and I wanted to mess with their heads. I wanted to fuck them up.
1, 2, 3, 4!
The no wave scene was really hated by most people I knew who were into the punk rock scene. It's like it was. I had friends who were like, "It's not music. It's ugly. It sounds bad. It's like horrible."
If you want to find what the sound of no wave was, it was truly DNA. It was truly the band that broke completely from everything that was happening in punk. And with Teenage Jesus, I mean, my God. I mean, it's just undefinable what the hell she was doing.
Very interesting music, but not really something you could dance to.
All right. Who the hell are you?
We're the band.
The band? Where's your instruments? What the...
In New York, punk rock became really equated with hip-hop, in a way.
And there was a period in the late 70s, especially in the early 80s, where those two scenes merged, hip-hop and punk rock in New York, at least socially.
Like with Rick Rubin getting involved with Run DMC and The Clash getting involved with hip-hop.
You gotta fight for your right to run!
They had records. They had turntables. They found two turntables. You could take a piece of this song and a piece of this song, and that was their instrumentation.
Hip-hop had a completely different attitude because it really had its eye on being really a communication tool, but at the same time it had no problems with going for the gold. And that was the difference in a way that I always noticed, that like punk rock sort of was embarrassed by riches.
Thanks to Glenn Branca, you have Sonic Youth, in my opinion.
I mean, for at least 2 years, no one came to their fucking concerts. You know, it was their constant perseverance and touring and getting records out and ambition that drove them to where they are.
And I know there's something down there.
But that was the point at which the labels just stopped paying any attention to people who in the 60s would have been like Frank Zappa and Captain Beefheart.
And that's when the music got really interesting to me. That's when the rubber hit the road. And all of a sudden these guys are going, screw ya, I'm going for the music instead of what you think and what the genre wants. Now that the spiky hair is gone, I see that you're a well-read guy, because now you can do songs that show me that you're a real artist. Oh, I can see that you're into different stuff. You're a Dadaist now. Okay, I'm very interested.
By the end of, say, oh, maybe mid-79, the only people playing punk music left were the people who really wanted to be there. And so there was this big split, which meant punk went more underground and got more intense, more purist in a way, which is both good and bad, and more hardcore.
The genre hardcore. It's American as, you know, fake wars and apple pie and baseball. It's when that fuck yeah guy got a guitar. He does that in the 7-Eleven parking lot. What the fuck are you looking at? That's his band. Okay, now he's got a guitar.
Bands that I loved, that I consider hardcore punk, it's probably the best way to say it, were bands like Black Flag, Circle Jerks, Dead Kennedys, a phenomenal band. They had so much great stuff to say.
Got this sick sense of humor that other people have, but they're not showing in their bands. What can I do with that? Plus, what would happen if I took the horror of Alice Cooper but made it about real things that happen to people? Instead of vampires and monsters, police brutality. You know, there was punk, and then there was more extreme punk, and people were calling it hardcore. They were surfers, they were skateboarders, and in some cases, they were very violent surfers and skateboarders. So out came the song Nazi Punks Fuck Off.
The Dead Kennedys also got tagged with that hardcore punk thing. Most people would concur it was kick-started by the appearance of the Damned. They came here very early in April 1977, caused a sensation. The Bags came up. Bags, the Germs, the Weirdos, the Screamers, you know, that another great band that actually never recorded, which is one of these biggest disappeared, undocumented legend of all time.
The Screamers were one of the most important influences on Dead Kennedys. As I said, there was both British stuff was influencing us, but also there was so many things right in our backyard that are largely unknown.
The Screamers show, I think, was probably my first punk rock show that I went to, official punk rock band punk rock show.
Every scene needs a center. Every scene needs a set of characters, a clubhouse.
I think without the mask, it wouldn't have grown. It wouldn't have flourished.
There was you know, a bit of the glam rock clique from West L.A. that coalesced around the Germs, the art school crowd that coalesced around the Weirdos.
East Coast, dirty cities, small, a lot of people, they, you know, people living high, stacked on top of each other, a lot of street crime, polluted skies, the ocean comes up to your ankle, and there's a dead guy floating in it. To California, sun, fun, beautiful girls, surfing, and punk rock. How can you have sun, hot chicks, surfboards, oranges, and punk rock?
A lot of people mistakenly think that because it's happening in California, sunny California, where kids are at the beach, that they have great lives, but, you know, you could have a messed up life anywhere.
From the East Coast to the West Coast, gotta go.
On the East Coast, often it's a little faster beat per minute, just because East Coast people, like what I am, we talk faster, we talk more, we're more in your face. Fuck you means fuck you, not hey, let's do lunch next week. It's on. And the music reflects it. Agnostic Front could have never come out of L.A.
It kind of went from punk to the new wave to the artsy stuff. And we weren't really nothing about that. We wanted just pure aggression. You know, that's when we started doing the circle pits and stuff and slam dancing.
Guys touching each other, sweating, flesh, spectral muscles, very homoerotic. You say, fellas, stop fighting, get a room, get it over with.
But lyrically now there was changes. There was bands like Minor Threat coming up with saying, like there was a straight edge movement, you know, which they considered no drink, no smoke, no fuck, whatever that was about.
The straight edge scene was coined, say, in Washington, D.C., with the teen idols or Minor Threat. We don't drink, we don't smoke, we don't fuck. You know, it was a way of self-control. It was a counterculture to the counterculture.
Fugazi, it's one of Ian MacKay's many bands. Ian had the Teen Idols, Ian had Minor Threat, which was a hugely influential band in this country. Fugazi has a few things they did and did not do, which were huge. First off, Fugazi will not do an interview in any publication that has ads that have liquor or tobacco in them. So Rolling Stone is like, pretty please do an interview. Sorry. Can you do it? Can you do an issue with no liquor or tobacco? No, then we can't talk to you.
Black Flag was hanging around. They were kind of like the second generation of bands. They were, this was even pre-Henry, because Henry was in Washington, D.C. This was the first generation of the band, Keith Morris.
We always had this just like go for it attitude. Like you can't wait around for somebody to do something for you. You have to do it for yourself. And I think a lot of that came out in the Black Flag music.
Effort, relax, get set, get the message from time, time, yeah!
When Black Flag started in 79, I think Henry Rollins joined, I think it was 1982. So Henry comes into it, he's more an East Coast figure. You know, that his, I guess, punk credentials came more from the Washington, D.C. side of it.
There's songs about cops. There's songs about killing yourself. There's songs about depression, the women who leave. The car has no brakes, and we're flooring it. We're going to hit something. So what? It's Black Flag.
I walk by your house if you are home.
They were the first band that were smart enough to tour and, you know, actually had their shit together enough to tour. And so that really helped them a lot, and helped us all a lot.
Black Flag's going through, the Dead Kennedys are going through, the independent labels are all swapping records, many, you know, independent distribution is coming along. America kind of ignites between summer 79 and summer 81, bam!
One night, a band from Washington came up here. And they were a black band. And they were playing, well, they said they were a hard rock band, punk band, and this was the Bad Brains.
See, I heard people telling me I played hardcore. I didn't know what the fuck hardcore was. I never even said hardcore in my life. I always thought hardcore was porno, like XXX or whatever. The Bad Brains sound is a sound of punk rock from the Dead Boys, a combination of Ramones, Sex Pistols, and Dead Boys. What you got in hardcore is the Bad Brains starting out playing punk rock and getting faster for some reason. If the drummer's bored, Earl, he want to go talk to a girl, he might play the songs all fast. I might be on stage looking at him like, dude, you're pissing me off, man, come on. And next thing you know, I become and create like a genre, you know what I mean? Like the speed. Music is fast, we want to try to play a little faster. If the music gets smooth right here, we got to make it nice and smooth. If the music is going to get buck wild right here, then it got to get buck wild.
Here you had Puerto Rican skinheads, you had Jewish skinheads, you had black skinheads. Nobody is going to get up on stage and be against anybody here. Otherwise, they'd be torn off the stage and thrown out.
I never would really want to hear nobody go, nigga. That shit happened to me in England. A kid who I was playing in England. He said, fucking Yankee nigga, go home. Spit on me and shit. I jumped down, punched him in the face.
Punk was now on the news, in the news. Everybody knew what it was, or thought they knew what it was.
Right around 92, everyone just curled up and started having their stomachs scratched by Sony. And they kind of went, and old people like me are going, you know, back in my day, we would have blown that up. And they're like, shut up, you old man. You're like, okay.
You pick up these punk books, you never see what's going on between those. They'll start mentioning like the Pistols, and then they'll mention like DC bands, like maybe Black Flag.
And then it's quiet. And they always say that. Then it's like, nothing happened until this little band from Seattle called Nirvana came in the late 80s. It's like a secret history in a way. It's like nobody really knows what happened in the 80s because there's really not much documentation of what exactly happened in underground music.
I'll tell you what happened in those 10 years. There were bands like us who were always having the roughest times of our lives, who believed in what we believed in, and still to date we're pursuing our beliefs and everything, and touring and putting out our records. But the crowds were a lot smaller, very underground, but very true like always. But that's the core of the audience, the core of the people.
So in the 80s, you had this gigantic underground movement. Now, eventually, the underground movement would turn into Nirvana, you know. I mean, Nirvana didn't sell 10 million records because, you know, they were so fucking great, which they were, but that audience had been building for more than 10 years.
It was almost as if Nirvana had taken all the lessons of the past and synthesize them down into their band and into their music in a way that it was palatable for the masses. The title itself, it's not about punk, it is punk.
All of a sudden, to have a band like Nirvana sort of come out, it completely was great in the way that it sort of galvanized everything that had been going on in those 10 years. But historians can only look at it as that moment because they don't know really where it came from. They think it comes out of a void. It didn't come out of a void.
Kurt Cobain and the Seattle scene tapped into a vast chunk of American white youth who are depressed, bummed out, and here's a guy who looks like them, comes from them, sings for them, about them, and to them. And all of a sudden, you got a Nirvana shirt on.
They were just good, you know? And it was great because no one could understand what they were saying, you know? It sounded like mashed potatoes or something. I remember that's when MTV came along and really broke out. And I think they needed someone like Nirvana, who was actually a good rock and roll band, to get behind. Much to Kurt Cobain's displeasure, you know, because he ended up killing himself because he had all these jerks hanging around him.
He swung his guitar, and the industry in 1 year had to go, reset. You're dropped. Your hair's too long. You better cut it or you're dropped. And all of a sudden, Alice in Chains are signed. Soundgarden is signed. Nirvana, and they're going multi-platinum.
It's basically people who were in... It's not rock-inspired punk bands. A lot of what got big, especially through Nirvana, was punk-inspired rock bands.
Shortly after that is when bands like Green Day became million sellers, and bands like Rancid came out of nowhere, and that led to bands like Blink 182 and Sum 41 that we have today.
It was just like, okay, now the media has finally said, punk rock happened now.
Nirvana, Sonic Youth, and the year that punk broke, basically, was the doors of all the major label, major record companies, basically saying, come on in.
I bet you're faking me out, you wear a mask. Faking me out, you wear a mask. Can I fit you, faking me out, you wear a mask.
The Korn music to me is very formulaic. You have your breakdown section, the little rap thing, and the DJ guy, and like, and it's all this, I wanted this and that, and then, because I'm a, and the crowd starts bouncing.
That's right, spring, spring.
You're like, this is a no-brainer. If I was 17, this would probably be my favorite band. And they pay off on those songs when that big guitar comes in. You can't help it. You're like, hell yeah, let's go wreck something.
Punk completely changed my life. It changed my attitude to culture. It changed my attitude towards what was possible. And I think I learned to go against the system a little bit.
Punk proved to people, and it is now ingrained in people, that what they thought was impossible is not impossible.
You didn't have to wait to start doing something. If you wanted to do it, you could try doing it.
Punk rock gave me a platform to put a band together and do it my way. And that was good for an 18-year-old kid.
Kids are still wanting the same thing as they wanted back then, something to express what they're feeling.
They get all this information from MTV and VH1, and that's their history of rock, and they find out that, like, well, it's like everything else. It's like school. You're not really getting the full story.
They were introduced to it as a package. They, you know, the business turned it into a commodity, if you will.
There's a lot of manufactured anger nowadays, if you ask me.
When you can make a dollar off it, it gets uploaded into the cultural lexicon. The slang becomes your normal patois of the day. You know, grunge becomes, you know, mom knows grunge now. As soon as mom knows how to say grunge, gotta go.
Back then, it was very much considered an anti-establishment, and it seems like today, most of the bands that do form want to be part of the establishment.
What they pay you for now is being stupid and making people stupider.
It's easy for a young person to say fuck you. I'm 43, I'm still saying fuck you. I'm still like pissed at something. You know, whatever you got, I'm mad at it. Where's the political awakening?
At this point and on the planet, it seems like 80% of the people are fucking asleep, you know?
Don't ask me why the cataclysmic state of the environment hasn't galvanize and, you know, mobilize people into doing something.
The more severe the political landscape becomes, the more repressive, the more valuable that the imagination becomes.
It's possible that music is not really the expression of it now as far as relating to world, what's happening in the world.
People doing visual arts, people doing literature, it's people doing film.
You know, Michael Moore making that movie against Bush is really punk.
Punk definitely had a major influence in the eruption of militant anti-corporate activism that first came to light over here in the Seattle protests.
The actual whole internet is a very punk idea.
Because of the internet, the record companies are losing their power to be kingmakers.
You can go make your own records. You can go put them out yourself. You can build your own little websites. You can do all these things by yourself.
Fuck you to corporations. Fuck you to branding everything. And fuck you to corporations having dictatorial control over society and governments.
Being able to look people in the eye and say, fuck you, I don't care what you think, I'm doing what I want to do. To have that to hold on to is really important to move forwards.
And that's the whole idea, it's to take the spirit and the inspiration and do your own thing with it.
All you need is one guy or girl to stand up and say, fuck this. And everyone goes, voice of a generation, thank you. I've been thinking that. I never had the guts to stand up and say it.
You only need 5%, you know, or less to, like, embrace ideas and change it. You know, change the way people think all over again.
It becomes a lineage. These people find each other and this timeline grows.